at the same time as the Vesak celebration. Vesak is the full moon of usually what happens in what we call May, when Buddhists celebrate the birth, the enlightenment, and the passing away of the Buddha. And this is considered to be one of the most sacred holidays in the Buddhist tradition. And we celebrated it last Monday in Palo Alto. Some of you were there. But the real day is tomorrow. So we can. This is a wonderful, auspicious date to have a retreat like this, and it can be maybe the kind of in the back of the theme or the kind of inspiration for the weekend is the actual enlightenment of the Buddha, the practice of the Buddha. The Buddha experienced or tasted release or freedom from compulsion and drivenness and fear and greed and hate, clinging. And in finding that release, he discovered a capacity of being present, a presence that was phenomenally at peace with the world. And in part, this is what we're doing here, is to discover that potential possibility for peace that each of us has within us. And in discovering this, the Buddha then proceeded to offer a path for us to follow so we could also have the same experience of release. The beginning of the path is usually described as being right understanding. And you find in the Buddhist tradition down through the ages that many, many teachers who've gone through the path themselves will often want to begin teaching people or begin help other people start their practice by emphasizing the importance of right understanding or right view. And there's various ways in which different teachers will emphasize right understanding. But one of the maybe more important things to say is that there's a tremendous effort in the Buddhist tradition to try to offer a context for the practice where the practice itself doesn't become a source of further suffering. So for example, the Buddha himself said that right understanding for this practice is the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths is understanding our suffering, understanding the causes of our suffering, the clingings that, and the fears and the aversions, the drivenness, the compulsion that causes us to suffer. And then understanding that there's a possibility of being released from those compulsive tendencies where that keep us constricted and tight and suffering. And then the fourth one is that there's a path. One of the meanings of the Four Noble Truths is that we have to apply them to the practice itself. If the practice itself is causing us to get really tight and we're judging ourselves or measuring our progress and kind of feeling disappointed or we're striving really in a tight way, if we feel in any kind of way, either even subtly, that we're suffering because of the way we practice, then the Four Noble Truths are offered as a corrective to that. Can you see, can you then study? It's very important then to look back at yourself and can you understand what that suffering is in relationship to the practice, and can you understand the causes of it, and can you discover the release from it, how to be at ease, at least in relationship to the practice. All of you will suffer in relationship to your practice. It's inevitable. What part of the value of coming on retreat is to help us release from some of our suffering and relax a little bit and kind of end the kind of momentum and frantic kind of life that some of us live normally, so we can see more clearly. But also part of the value of doing meditation practice in a more ongoing way than we do kind of in a daily sitting practice at home is that the ongoing all through the day meditation practice reveals to us subtle ways which are invisible in daily life that we use the practice in ways that are not so healthy and that we suffer because of it. And so actually when you begin suffering because of the practice, take that as being in a kind of funny way a good sign. Because it means that you have a chance now to purify that. You have a chance to look at that and find how to practice without adding any kind of extra expectation or demand or striving, or without identifying with it, or without measuring yourself by it, or having some particular idea of what the goal should be. You know, you're supposed to get calm, or you're supposed to be filled with bliss, or you're supposed to get concentrated. There's all these supposed tos and shoulds that are sometimes involved with the way we practice that cause us to suffer. So the Buddha offered that reflection. You know, can you reflect on the Four Noble Truths as a way of understanding your practice, so that the practice can be a little bit more, try to bring some kind of ease and maybe even some joy in the practice itself. Another reflection, which some teachers like to reflect on at the beginning of practice, for right understanding, right view, is to reflect on our relationship to nature. And it's beautiful, I think, to be here in a natural setting. And to be reminded, you know, that the Buddha spent much of his life in natural settings. It's said that he was born under a tree. It's said that he was enlightened under a tree. And it's said that he died under laying down under two trees. So the idea of being in nature, something about being in contact with trees and nature, which certainly can, for many people, can bring a sense of inspiration, a sense of peace, a sense of ease or relaxation. And perhaps some people can feel a connection with nature. They feel, well, maybe I'm not different from nature. Maybe nature is my nature. We can often kind of hold ourselves as being human beings kind of above nature, separate from it, which is a kind of suffering in itself. But to walk around here and enjoy the trees, the skies, the fog, the pond, the frogs, the crickets, the birds, the deer, you know, that maybe if you go up on the ridge up here, you might be able to see the ocean. You can see rolling hills along the distance. And to kind of understand yourself as being part of nature, this wonderful, supportive environment here. I find myself, you know, in my early years of practice, I found a lot of inspiration in this very kind of rudimentary reflection. You know, I'd look at a tree, and look at trees, and the trees would all look very different from each other. And each tree looked perfect just the way it was. You know, I didn't say, well, that tree, because it has a burl there, or that branch is a little bit crooked in the wrong way there, or, you know, or that tree is not tall enough, or that tree, you know, is leaning too far in one direction. Therefore, that tree is bad or wrong. Mostly I look at trees, and each tree, you know, seems perfect in and of itself as it is. And that was very helpful for me when I looked at myself. Can I see, look at myself or look at other people in the same way? To recognize, you know, that I'm crooked some ways, I lean some ways, but that doesn't detract from the perfection of who each of us are. We can somehow look at both of it. We can look at our shortcomings, we can look at the difficulties and our suffering, and the path of practice is somehow come to terms with that and find the release from it. But at the same time, the context for looking at all that is a context of seeing perhaps the perfection of ourselves, or seeing how we're part of nature. We don't have to be so judgmental and see ourselves in a negative way. So that's another reflection some people will bring for right understanding, kind of to let nature hold ourselves, be a container for ourselves. And in doing that, not use the kind of anthropocentric kind of judgments and concerns and comparative thinking, which causes so much suffering for who we are. A lot of our suffering comes from comparative thinking. Again, the shoulds and shouldn'ts. I should be that kind of person. I should be better than that. But I'm not as good as that person. So that reflection. Another reflection that sometimes is helpful at the beginning of practice is to reflect on that each of us, in our own way, maybe when we were children, maybe later in life, have tasted some kind of experience of well-being, of peace or calm. Maybe it's not much, but we've experienced some. And all of us have experienced states of suffering and distress. And is not inherent in the nature of who we are, in the nature of the mind and the heart, to only be suffering or only be filled with joy. Right, these kind of states of the mind come and go. And to realize somehow the impermanence and not be caught up and not be fixated on this particular state that I have right now, but to hold it, to view it from the great perspective of impermanence. These things come and go. And that I have the potential inside of me for the full range of human experience. I don't have to be fixated on the particular one I have right now. I also have the potential for joy. I also have the potential for peace and happiness. To reflect on impermanence is very, very helpful for some people. Another reflection, kind of right understanding, the beginning of the path, is a little bit like this. I think many people, I don't know if everyone's had this experience, but many people had the experience of being suddenly in a position of great danger, and then finding that situation, there was no, nothing dangerous happened. I mean, for example, maybe you almost had a tremendous auto accident. You're on the freeway and someone, just oncoming traffic suddenly pulled over into your lane, in the last second. And somehow miraculously you were able to, without even thinking, pull over into the shoulder of the road and you could almost, smell the breath of the driver, as he whizzed by you. And you thought for a moment, you thought for sure you were a goner. And then miraculously nothing happened to you, you were fine. And something like that, And when I was skiing many, when I was a kid, I remember once falling on the slope. It was foggy, so you couldn't see down slope what was there. And I thought it was kind of cool to just kind of fall and slip, so I must have slide for a while. And then I caught myself and stood up. And when I stood up, I could see beyond where the fog was. And I was like 4 feet from this huge cliff. So there are experiences. I think auto kind of experiences perhaps are the most dramatic. You kind of suddenly find yourself alive again. And so much of the momentum and the concerns and the things we were kind of caught up in just before have somehow been cleaned out, just washed away. Certainly sometimes they seem really petty in relationship to this preciousness of now being alive. But there can be for some people a kind of experience of tremendous stillness or tremendous spaciousness or expansiveness. Perhaps a kind of peace. And it seems like all the kind of life continues. And it's like almost as if you're kind of in a life has a very different, for a few minutes or a few moments or a few hours, life has a very different feeling to it because there's a stillness or this kind of perspective, this openness, or where the mind or the awareness is not latching on to everything. It's not like, oh, I have to do that, I have to do that, I have to worry about that, I have to be concerned about that, or I have to remember that, or, we have all these concerns we get kind of caught up in. And you watch all that like a drama that's kind of like not really your life almost. And we realize that aside from the arising and passing of emotions and feelings and joy and sorrow, and there is a kind of presence which is always there, which is usually covered over by our constant preoccupation with the details of life. And that presence is a phenomenally still presence, a kind of a peaceful presence. That's very different than the kind of peace that kind of just comes from being really relaxed or not being in conflict with your neighbor or something. And some people can reflect on that if they've had that kind of experience. And that can be the kind of beginning of the path. They go, oh, there is something, a part of who I am, which is not so caught up or is not involved, not caught up with the details of life and who I am and what I need to do and the relationships I need to fix and the problems I need to solve. There's something else which is much more vaster and more precious and peaceful. And to let that be the context, and oh, that's what holds me, that's what holds my life. And so then mindfulness is a lot to do with paying attention to what's actually happening in the present moment. But as we pay attention to it, there's a kind of this reminder that, oh, There's something much more going on here, mysteriously more, than what's going on in the present moment, in what I can actually focus on. And maybe I can be a little more relaxed about what's actually happening in the present moment. I can be more at ease because of that. So what I'm trying to offer you this evening is a kind of a series of different ways in which the Buddhist tradition has tried to get people started on the Buddhist path. They try very hard to get people started in such a way that they kind of feel kind of good about themselves. That's the kind of main word. Can you feel kind of good about yourself? And it's not so easy to feel good about ourselves. I don't want to say it lightly, as if it's, you can do that easily. But to try to come into the beginning of practice with maybe feeling good about yourself, or at least not being so, being a little bit lighter, a little more ease about the kind of difficulties and the sorrows, the griefs, the sadnesses that we come into the practice with. Some of you come, there's a room full of people here coming with many different backgrounds to the retreat. And I want to start by just saying that deep respect for whatever you bring to the retreat to start off the retreat with. And there can be tremendous diversity here. And there can be great suffering in the room, great difficulty that some of you will have that you come here and retreat for. And some of you maybe don't come with great suffering, but come with great tiredness. And sometimes coming, just get ready to come to a retreat like this is kind of stressful. and so people show up here and they're kind of tired. And so then to take care of yourself and get lots of rest if you're really tired. Take a nap tomorrow if that's what you need. So there's many ways in which people come in here. But if you can see, if you can check into yourself and see if there's any resources inside of yourself or any of the reflections I offered you that help kind of offer kind of a more compassionate container for how you do the practice this weekend, that would be really great. So we come to the end of the near the end of the first full day of of being on retreat, of practicing. And it coincides with the day that our tradition celebrates the enlightenment of the Buddha, his birth, his enlightenment, his passing away. And I suppose what it means is that last night would have been the night the Buddha stayed up all night. And then in the morning, with the morning the morning star, he attained his full awakening, his full release. And the tradition in Japan is that the Buddha attained his enlightenment on a different day than when he was born. They kind of spread it out through the year a little bit better. And in Japan, Japanese Zen tradition, his enlightenment is December 8th. And in Japan, they have a 7-day sesshin retreat that ends by staying up all night, the night of the 7th into the morning of the 8th, because it's considered very auspicious to spend the whole night sitting up and like the Buddha did at the end of a retreat. And I was in Japan one year where sitting this particular kind of sesshin, and that's what we did. We stayed up until dawn doing our zazen and kinhin, zazen and walking meditation, and then at dawn, we kind of ended and went off and had breakfast, nice meal, and then we all went into the ofuro, the hot baths, hot tubs, and soaked. And then the rest of the day was kind of off. So the idea of staying up, so we're coming to the end, kind of the end of many of you for this day. You probably go to sleep after the 9:30 sitting, 9 o'clock sitting. But some of you maybe will be inspired to stay up late, stay up and sit through the night, wait until the dawn comes, like the Buddha did. The first day of a retreat is often difficult for people, and I don't think I said that well enough last night or this morning, and I should have clarified that. And even for the people who've done this many times, it's nice to hear it and be reminded that there's a lot of sleepiness usually, a lot of momentum from before coming on retreat. And so it can be really difficult to get settled. And we have this intention to, you know, to get concentrated or get calm or to get, you know, into the meditation or, you know, whatever we think our intention is. And our minds and our bodies seem to frustrate our best intentions. And this is part of what often happens the first day or two, and it's considered to be part of the course of practice. And if I had warned you better, maybe you wouldn't have, some of you wouldn't maybe have struggled as much as you did. But on the other hand, I think it's very important to look at the difficulties that come up in practice as very important opportunities. The sufferings and the frustrations that we have in practice, they themselves are the juncture, the meeting point where it's possible to go deeper into our life and clarify our life, purify our life, understand the causes and conditions for that suffering. So if you have some great attachment to needing to be, you know, the most concentrated meditator on the retreat, and then you find frustration the first day because you don't seem to be getting concentrated enough, if you actually take that frustration seriously and bring your mindfulness to it, and maybe you can see then maybe that particular attachment to be the most concentrated person on the retreat, and to pick a kind of silly example, and clarify that and purify it and find the release from that kind of attachment. So I think that in the teachings of the Buddha, as I understand them, our sufferings are also opportunities. And maybe that's kind of a cliche to say that. People say that often. But I think it's really true. And if you really want to become really free of your suffering and really find release, it's better to take your suffering seriously than to kind of trash about or run away or just get more and more restless. But really stop and kind of, what's going on here? I know in my early years of practice, I wouldn't stop from my suffering on retreat. I didn't think my suffering, you know, was what retreat was about, or, you know, I just didn't think that was had anything to do with what practice was about, was my suffering particularly. So I just went ahead and suffered more and more and didn't bring my attention to it. And I just kind of thought, it was a practice. So I tried to practice, get concentrated, and be with my breath or whatever. And the more I tried, the more frustrating I got. And I hadn't been taught to stop and take a good look when the frustration first began. So it just grew and grew and grew. So we sit here on the in a little Zen center on the day of the Buddha's enlightenment. It reminds me of the poem by Ryokan, where Ryokan lived in a small little hut in the woods, and he didn't own much, but he had a few things, I guess, in his hut, a pen and paper and his zafu and a few things. And he came back one day to discover that someone had stolen everything from his little hut, and there was nothing left except, so he went and sat down, and then he composed a poem that said, "The thief, he left it behind, the moon in the window." And somehow he was able to see something really precious that was left behind, something that couldn't be stolen. Now, when a Japanese poet writes about the moon, you have to immediately think of it as being symbolic, in addition to its literal. Probably there was a moon that was left behind. But when Ryokan saw maybe the full moon sitting in the empty hut and looking out the window and saw the full moon, he was also then reminded, it resonated with the idea that the full moon is symbolic for our enlightenment, for our Buddha nature, for full enlightenment. The Buddha was enlightened on the full moon, and down through the ages, the idea of the full moon with all its luminosity and clarity is a symbol for freedom, for enlightenment. So the thief, he left it behind, the moon in the window. I think it's a beautiful idea. who's the thief that takes everything from us? And when everything has been taken from us, what is left? You know, to have all the windows and doors completely open so the moonlight can stream in, and to have nothing that we're holding on to or clinging to. I felt many times in my own practice that everything was being taken away from me. And I didn't think about it until now this way, but it was almost as if my Buddhist practice was the thief. And everything was being taken away. And everything but the full moon in the window. Because what I found in my own practice was in the times when I felt really challenged by the practice or challenged by life, and that when everything, all my attachments, all my sense of identity of who I was, all my orientations for what I thought I needed in life, were in some sense couldn't be maintained, upheld in the full power of practicing. When everything was taken away, there was always something left. And what was left? And I found that what was left was one of the most precious things that I know. And it became a real source of strength and a source of inspiration for me to have everything in a sense taken away, but something's left. And what is that? I remember the many, many months. I spent 8 months sitting in kind of more or less solitary retreat in Burma. I had a little room that I sat in all my sittings, and except for talking to the teacher for 10-15 minutes a day or so, I didn't talk to anyone. And I just did my walking meditation outside in a little hallway outside my room, and the mosquitoes were too bad, I'd do them inside the room. And day after day I sat in my bed meditating there. And it's still a very powerful memory for me, the sense of phenomenal, the sense of being alone in the universe was a sense I had sitting there. There was nothing, you know, I was completely alone. It was me and the universe, and it felt right. It didn't feel like blissful. It didn't feel like, you know, ecstatic exactly, but it felt so right. I felt so at home, just me and the universe, being alone in the universe, just me, and nothing else. Seemingly, you know, nothing else, no friends, no money, no activities that could generate any particular fame or gain or whatever, and I was just there, you know, day after day. It was kind of like this image I had sometimes was kind of like I was just looking, I was in space, and just looking out into the depth of space, and there was nothing else. So I don't know if that's an interesting or useful image for any of you. But the idea being that there is something really precious about being alive that is not contingent or dependent upon any of the things that we can accomplish or gain or any of the kind of relationships we can have. We don't need anything for this kind of well-being. And I'm very grateful to my experiences and practice to have had everything, had the thief come and take everything away except for the moon and the window. One of the nice things about the image of the moon, the full moon for enlightenment, is that even when it's foggy, the full moon is there. And so sometimes we're kind of foggy, right? Or some equivalent of it. But this wonderful thing, this precious thing about that who we are when, you know, in our depths is always there. And to kind of know that that's a possibility, it's a potential, something's always there. It might get covered for a while, but to know that it's there is, for many people, is an inspiration or encouragement. And actually, you know, if you think about it, the moon is always full. It isn't simply, you know, sometimes it's full, certain times of the month. I mean, the moon, what does the moon think? You just, you know, I'm always full, thank you. you know, it's only from our perspective here on the earth that we see these shadows, and we call it, you know, half moon or sliver moon or whatever, new moon. The moon's always full. So the enlightenment of the Buddha, we celebrate today the birth, the enlightenment, and the death of the Buddha. And I like it that that all these three things, events of the Buddha's life, are celebrated together. And that somehow that between birth and his death, there's this experience of his release, his freedom, his what we call in English often his enlightenment. And one of the reasons I like it is that the birth of the Buddha and the death of the Buddha is something we all share with him. That those experiences belong to his common humanity, the common humanity of all of us. And if you read the suttas, the discourse of the Buddha's last days, there's a great description where he talks about himself as being old. And it's lovely to read. You know, I think it's lovely. Maybe, who knows, if you think it's lovely. Or he thought it was lovely. But to read the Buddha talking about himself being frail and old and full of pains, and his body not really being held together very well anymore. And being in a lot of physical pain because of his old body. And so in another discourse, he talks about being all bent over, hunched over in his old age, and being full of wrinkles in his old age. Very different image of the Buddha than this, all these wonderful statues we have of him, where he's eternally and forever, you know, just the pinnacle of, you know, youthful. And he actually says, very touching in this last discourse, he says, the Buddha says, that the only way he gets any relief from his physical pain is by going into deep meditation, where he doesn't really feel connected, you know, doesn't really feel his body anymore. But in his normal life, he feels a lot of pain. And he gets sick near the end of his life, and this course describes him having a bloody dysentery. Imagine the Buddha with bloody dysentery. I mean, it's not supposed to happen that way, right? Once you're enlightened, it's supposed to be happily ever after kind of thing, right? So the Buddha shared the common humanity with us. He was born, he got old, and he died. His birth that we commemorate, I imagine that it was a difficult birth. You know, back in India in that time, births were difficult. Death and sickness was all too common part of birth. So then Buddha said that birth, old age, and death as kind of the three symbolic representations of human suffering. We have to understand it in the context of ancient India, where, I don't know, maybe a majority of childbirths were at least difficult, phenomenally difficult, maybe with a lot of death. And in fact, the Buddha's mother died when he was 7 days old. So I imagine that she died after 7 days after the birth because of the complications from the birth. So we share that with the Buddha. We share suffering and old age and death and sickness. And it isn't that practice is supposed to separate us from those existences, and so those experiences are not part of our life anymore. But in between these experiences of the birth and death of the Buddha had his experience of release, his freedom. And in a sense, this is what is the difference between us and the Buddha. We share the common humanity, but the Buddha, in that humanity, in that world of birth, sickness, old age, and death, he discovered that it's possible. He discovered the full moon. He discovered the experience, possibility of being released from all of our attachments, all of our clingings, all of our fears, all of our anxieties, all of our self-identifications, all of our all the kind of optional sufferings, all the ways in which we add suffering on top of our human life. And it's interesting, one of the descriptions the Buddha gave This is a little bit gruesome, but it's ancient India, and maybe, you know, if it was in modern 20th century, he could have come up with a nicer metaphor. But he was just using a metaphor of, you know, his time that people could see, were familiar with. A description of he gave of the of how an enlightened person is different after their release. He said it's like if a butcher goes and takes the hide off a dead cow, and say does a really good job taking the hide off, the butcher could in fact put the hide back on again once taking the hide off. Could in fact put the hide back on that cow, and it would fit. You know, it kind of fit there. You know, it more or less fit. It would kind of wrap around the way it was before. But it would never stick again. It would never be attached. It would never be firmly, you know, the cow stood up. you know, it came to life again. You know, the skin would just fall off. Excuse me for... So the idea being that somehow that skin will never fit again. It never be attached again. So the same way when a person experienced release, like the Buddha had, all the aspects of our common humanity, our personality, our the momentum of our past lives, our past life, a lot of things still exist for us, don't go away. But there's a kind of a little bit distance. It's like the attachment, the clinging, has been severed, and you're still involved. Maybe like the more Western. Famous Western description of being in the world but not of the world. So kind of being involved, still being here in the world, but there not being the clinging or the holding. But otherwise, there's no difference in any kind of important way between the Buddha and us. The Buddha lacked that clinging, that holding. And a lot of what mindfulness practice is about is to try to help us have for ourselves that experience of release. And everyone who does mindfulness practice for some time has some experience of this. And it might be initially in very small degrees of release. Maybe we realize after some time of practice that it's no longer necessary to view oneself in the same way as we have for 30, 40, 50 years. Maybe the idea that we're unworthy, we see that just an idea, and we find release from this constant kind of barrage of thoughts, you know, I'm not good enough, I'm not as good as the next person. Or we realize perhaps that we've always been trying to live up to some kind of unrealistic ideal of who we should be. And we see it really clearly, the ideal and the futility of it and the unnecessariness of it. And then there's a release from that, perhaps, even just a small degree. Maybe it comes back, but each time it comes back, maybe it's not quite as tenacious. I remember on my first Vipassana retreat, my first one was in Thailand, and I had a lot of leg pain during that retreat. And I was sat for, my first retreat was 10 weeks long. So I didn't, you know, it got kind of painful. And I remember going every day for a while to my teacher and then through the translator explaining, oh, you know, I have all this physical leg pain, and, you know, basically I was telling him, give me some advice, it goes away. And so he would tell me what to do, you know, give me some good Vipassana instructions, you know, be aware of it, note it, investigate it. You know, try to, you know, look at your relationship to it, you know, and, you know, kind of practice equanimity to it, and, you know, all kinds of things. And I did it, and I came back the next day and complained more, and it was hurting some more. And after about 3 or 4 days of this, as I was leaving the little cabin of the teacher, the translator followed me, and he kind of whispered to me or said, you know, Gil, you're really attached to that pain, aren't you? And I was just shocked. Attached to the pain? Au contraire. No way. I mean, that's, you know, I just want to get rid of it. Absolutely, you know. I'm trying to get rid of it here. I'm desperately trying to get rid of it. I'm not attached to it. I'm just get it out of my life. But it kind of caught my attention, this idea. You're attached to it. So I went back and spent some time kind of reflecting on this idea of being attached to it. And I realized that there was a lot of attachment in relationship to the pain. I was attached to physical comfort. I had ideas of if I was really a good meditator, I wouldn't have any physical pain. I had, which was kind of an attachment I had. I had attachment to, attachment to being pain-free. And the resistance and aversion is a kind of attachment also. It's a kind of fixation, a holding, a tightening down in its own way. And I saw, wow, there's a lot of attachment here in this physical pain. And as soon as I saw the attachment, the pain didn't go away. But I was found some release from that attachment. And the pain became not a big deal anymore. And the pain remained. And with time, after a few days or something, it kind of went away by itself. But it didn't really need to anymore because I'd stopped being so concerned about it. And part of the attachment to the pain was I was so preoccupied with it. And it kind of built, my preoccupation built, and it loomed to be this huge, monstrous kind of difficulty and struggle. And somehow when I investigated this idea of how I was attached to it, I was released from being bothered by it. And this has happened a number of times in my practice, that what I was being bothered by didn't go away, but I stopped being bothered. And maybe that's a kind of very simple, beautiful description of one of a kind of release. Stop being bothered by things. Suzuki Roshi used to teach in relationship to your thinking and during meditation, don't be bothered by them. And I've known people who've been phenomenally bothered by their thoughts and thinking something's terribly wrong with them. And then I remember one friend of mine who practiced for years and he started meditation because he just thought he couldn't stand it. In fact, he was thinking all the time. And what he came to after a few years was he didn't stop thinking so much, but he stopped being bothered by it. And I don't know if that's a useful idea for any of you, but the idea of not being bothered has been very important for me. And it's been helpful because it means that you don't have to get rid of things to find your release. It has much more to do with your relationship to it and finding a new relationship. So the Buddha sat down some 2,543 years or so ago under the Bodhi tree, and it said that he vowed to sit there until he became free, until he discovered his release, or discovered the solution, the dissolution, the dissolving of suffering. And he wasn't going to get up until he did that. But it's interesting, what preceded his determination to sit there and his very firm resolve. And maybe many of you heard me tell the story, but I'm fond of it. Hopefully you're fond of listening to it. in the mind of the Buddha, at least in his mind, he understood there were two options in India at his times for how to live life. And maybe it's a bit simplistic, but for him the two options was, one was a life of indulging in all kinds of sense pleasures, being involved in just every possible video game and massage, spa, and every possible gourmet food, and just having a great time with just sense pleasures and perhaps the kind of life of the lay people at his time was one of didn't have any other options, didn't have any really maybe a lot of spiritual options, and so the happiness that people, a lot of people knew, was that of just having worldly happiness, of delighting in the good things in life. But in any case, that was one extreme that the Buddha saw, the extreme of just indulging in sense pleasures, sensual gratification. And there are people in our society who take that extreme form. And usually when they do take it to the extreme form of just the whole life is about sense gratification, their lives usually spiral down to kind of a disaster. And the other extreme that he saw was the that of self... self-repression, of self-denial is the word I'm looking for. The ascetic path, where you denied the self, you starved the self. The notion that there's a self that's attached, you know, our attachment, the self and attachment are closely connected. And if you can just starve yourself and your soul, then starve kind of the body in a sense, then the soul would be set free, and you'd find your release. And so the Buddha took a great heroic effort in self-denial. And it said that he was the most extreme ascetic of his time. And there's graphic descriptions that he gives of people mistaking him for a corpse because he was so emaciated and laying there and not moving. And at one point he stumbled into a river and almost drowned. And he realized that if he pursued the ascetic practice one iota more, he would die. And he was that good at it. And he didn't see much purpose in just dying. And he didn't. So he turned away from it and thinking, well, self-denial doesn't seem the way to go. And so those are the kind of the two extremes that he saw were his options. And he was didn't know how to proceed, because those are the only things he knew how to do. So his father, being the king, had to preside over the official first plowing of the ground, and you know, had the ceremonial plow and the ceremonial oxen and the ceremonial blue jeans and overalls that you need to have to do the ceremonial plowing. And so the whole village, was a whole country or whatever, was out there, you know, attending to this. But the six-year-old Buddha, he was left underneath the tree at the edge of the field, forgotten, because, you know, it wasn't that important to pay attention. You know, what really was going on was the plowing. So he was left there, and he sat there kind of cross-legged on the ground underneath a rose apple tree. And without a care in the world, and it was a comfortable situation, and without needing to be anybody or attain anything or prove himself to anybody or have anybody intrude on him and want his affection or whatever parents, you know, tried to do. And in doing that, he just sat there, and he dropped into an experience of joy, of being deeply settled on himself and concentrated on himself. The mind became quiet and undistracted, and he experienced a lot of joy. So when he was 36 years old, he remembered, or 35 years old, he remembered this experience from 30 years before. And he remembered this experience was a kind of joy which didn't arise out of sense pleasure, sense gratification. It wasn't like any of the senses were being activated, or being, you know, he wasn't getting a massage or eating or, you know, whatever we do for sense pleasure. And he said, well, maybe there's another way. Maybe there's a way of finding some kind of well-being that's not dependent on sense pleasure. It's maybe he thought it was kind of in the nature of who we are rather than what we create and what we make. So he said, well, maybe how I was sitting when I was six years old. Maybe something by that way in which I was sitting is the way to go forward here and find the solution to what I'm looking for. And so that's what he did. He sat down, and then and that's when he made his firm resolve. He made his resolve that may I sit here with absolutely still, unmoving, until I attain my release. And for me, it is beautiful double image then, it is double quality. That on one hand, the Buddha resolves to sit there as a child, or with childlike openness that he had when he was 6 years old. Maybe kind of like the mythic child who's always completely open to the world. And my child is 16 months old now. He's fluent at saying no. You know, where's that openness? You know, and I don't ask him, you don't ask questions, you know, 16 month old. You tell them, this is what you're doing. Did you ask them the question? Nope. Nope. You're supposed to be open. Nope. So anyway, but sometimes they're quite open. So anyway, to be open in this way of not trying to make anything happen, not trying to push anything away, not trying to construct anything. Just I call it the experience of leaving oneself alone. And I think a lot of what meditation practice is about is learning how to leave oneself alone. If all you learn to do in your meditation practice is leave yourself alone, you'll have an easy time. We're learning to leave ourselves alone. But, and what happened when he did that is this. And this again is somewhat symbolic language. You can imagine if someone spent, if you spent 6 years denying all your inner impulses for every kind of desire you possibly want, your sexuality and sexual thoughts, your desires for food and eating, and your desires for companionship and your desires for comfort, or you know, every kind of possible human kind of desire you might have, you kind of kept squashing it and pushing it down and denying it, and no, not that, not that. You kind of push it out, kind of back into the shadows, and refuse to have that part of your life. And then suddenly you stop doing that. Imagine what will happen. So the Buddha placed himself with firm resolve beneath the Bodhi tree. This is a modern rendition of the story. This is not scriptural, but I think it's nice. He placed himself with a firm resolve beneath the Bodhi tree on the immovable spot, and straight away appeared all his repressed forces. Kama, Mara, the god of death and lust. The dangerous god appeared mounted on an elephant, carrying weapons in his thousand hands. He was surrounded by his army, which extended 12 leagues before him, 12 to his right, 12 to his left, and in the rear, as far as to the confines of the world, it was 9 leagues high. The protecting deities of the universe took flight, but the future Buddha remained unmoved beneath the tree. And the god then assailed him, seeking to break his concentration. Whirlwind, rocks, thunder and flame, smoking weapons with keen edges, burning coals, hot ashes, boiling mud, blistering sands, and fourfold darkness, the antagonist hurled against the Savior, but the missiles were all transformed into celestial flowers and ointments by the power of the Buddha's 10 perfections. Mara then deployed his daughters, desire, pining, and lust, surrounded by voluptuous attendants, but the mind of the great being was not distracted. The god finally challenged his right to be sitting on the immovable spot, and Mara flung his razor-sharp discus angrily and bid the towering hosts of the army to let fly at the Buddha with mountain crags. But the future Buddha only moved his hand to touch the ground with his fingertips, and thus bid the goddess Earth bear witness to his right to be sitting where he was. The Earth, she did so with 100,000 roars. So the elephant of the antagonist fell upon its knees in homage to the future Buddha. The army was immediately dispersed, and the gods of all the worlds scattered garlands. So you think you had a hard time today. So you know, 6 years of repression kind of came right back at the Buddha with all this stuff. And in this childlike openness, he allowed it to come. He didn't flinch. He didn't run away from it. He didn't grab a hold of it. He didn't run off with the voluptuous maidens. He just sat there, and in his sitting there, it all kind of dissolved into flowers. It's a lovely image, and I think it actually works that way. If we can maintain our openness, leaving ourselves alone, and just stay open, being very mindful of what's going on, not resisting things, but also not indulging or getting involved in things, and just letting it kind of be there, without any involvement in our part. Everything self-liberates. Everything will find its relief. Everything, in a sense, metaphorically, will turn into celestial flowers. And it's not easy to do this, of course, but I think this is one of the ways in which to practice. There's other ways of practicing, of course, but this is one of the ways to practice, is to practice willingness to bring mindfulness, bring ourselves, to really pay attention to what's happening in the present moment, and allow the present moment to be exactly as it is, no matter how difficult it is. And it might get more difficult first. You might find you struggles with it at times. But the dedication is to find some way to simply allow things to exist without anything needing to be any different. To let the mountain crags and all the weapons kind of just come as they wish. Nothing needs to be any different. To let all the joys and delights of life and of meditation to come also. Let all the experiences of calm and peace that are possible, let them come also. But also not get involved in those. Let them come and do what they wish. Let them self-liberate. Don't get involved in them and judging them or clinging to them or manipulating them or holding on to them. And I just love it, this image of these two things that are necessary. This great openness and this firm resolve. And I know some people, what they need to do is to develop more the side of the resolve, to be able to sit with some kind of strength. And other people need to have less of that, in a sense, less resolve, or maybe not less, but at least a lot more openness and willingness just to experience life as it is. And each of us may be at different times, so we need different parts of that equation. Sometimes we need more openness, sometimes we need more resolve to sit still with what's going on. And I love it that the final weapon of Mara was to assail the Buddha with doubt, saying, you know, what right do you have to get enlightened? What right do you have to become free? And I think for many of us, the most difficult hindrance for our release is doubt. You know, especially maybe a sense of unworthiness. How could I experience such a wonderful thing, such a lofty thing? How could I become free? How can I, it takes many forms, but how can I not be concerned? How can I not worry about the things my family tells me I'm supposed to worry about? How can I not pursue the kind of pursuits that my society tells me I need to pursue? How can I not there's all these kind of doubts that come in. And what I love about this is not simply that the doubt came, but what I love about this story is that that this is the one time the Buddha moved. He flinched. He blinked. his resolve and his openness, what he could bring himself to the practice, wasn't enough. And what he had to do was he put his hand down over his right knee and touched the earth, and he called upon the earth to be his witness to his right to be free. And for me, what this means is that he reminded himself or established his connection to the earth, to the Mother Earth, or to nature. And he felt that he was nature. He's no different than nature. That his right to become free, his right to leave himself alone and not to live through all these messages of shoulds and shouldn'ts, all these clingings and attachments, that it's because of the inseparable connection to nature, being nature itself, that freed the Buddha from his last doubt. He needed to connect to something larger than himself. He needed to find something larger than his own self-image, self-concern, even his own practice, his own abilities, to offer him some kind of to offer him that last release of doubt. And with the release of that doubt, then they're unfolded for the Buddha in its own natural way, the deeper experiences of release, of insight. And it's said that then with the morning star, that Buddha understood that he had been freed, he'd been released from all the attachments, the clingings that he had had. I think that to do a practice like we're doing here this weekend, I think it's one of the most beautiful things, one of the most amazing things that exists in this world, that there are people who are willing to do this. And I think it's very difficult to do. It has its rewards and it has its challenges, but it's really a marvelous, marvelous thing to do. And it's really, I feel, a phenomenal offering that we give to the rest of the world. That there are people in the world who are willing to look deeply at themselves, willing to stop for themselves, willing to investigate themselves, willing to have the courage to really be present for themselves as they are. I think is a great offering to the world. The image in Japan of enlightenment, and enlightenment is found everywhere, is the image of the moon in the dewdrop. No matter how large or small a body of water is, it still reflects the moon. And even in the small dewdrop, the full moon of enlightenment is right there. No matter what our capacities and capabilities are, the possibility of release is found in everyone. So the moon and the dewdrop. But the other image that I have is kind of parallel to that, is the image of the earth in a teardrop. The moon and the dewdrop and the earth and the teardrop. These two sides of Buddhism, wisdom and compassion. Enlightenment is the wisdom side, and compassion, the experience of feeling the suffering of the world and our suffering, and getting fueled by that, getting inspired by that in a sense, getting some strength from that to practice and encouragement to practice for everyone's sake. These two wings, these two drops, the teardrop and the dewdrop, and the two things being reflected, the earth and the teardrop and the moon and the dewdrop. So practice involves both. And sometimes we are the dewdrop, and sometimes we're the teardrop. And it's not your choice which one you're getting today or tomorrow or whenever. The last thing I want to say this evening is, in order to practice Buddhism or to live a life of freedom, we have to understand both ways, he says. And then he said, most people are like the tambankan, which is a Japanese word for a man who's carrying, a person who carries a kind of a canoe on one shoulder. If you're carrying a canoe on one shoulder, kind of it blocks your view on that other side of that shoulder. So you only see one side. And you go around life and you only see that one side. kind of like you have one-sided blinder. He said most people are that way. And what we need to do is to develop the ability to see both ways. Elsewhere, Suzuki Roshi said, it's not, the essential teachings of Zen is not always so. It's not always so. And the idea that there's maybe always two points of view, two perspectives, that we tend as human beings, many of us, to kind of want to find one solution, one right kind of path or way. And Suzuki Roshi is saying, no, it's, you know, it's always both ways. So you see, there's a number of perspectives we can have. So this perspective, it's both kind of a childlike openness and an adult-like firmness that are needed. And for someone to tell you that all you need is to be firm and, you know, in your practice and diligent, it will do you a disservice. But if someone only tells you you're supposed to be completely just open and just receptive, and that's all, maybe that's kind of not enough either. So in terms of mindfulness practice, I see two ways that the mindfulness practice is done or unfolds. And the two can be the same, but they can also be different. They involve the same, basically, you know, anyway. The two, one is that mindfulness practice is, on one hand, is bringing the most careful attention we have to notice what's happening in the present moment. So the first thing is we have to learn how to be in the present moment. So today I suggested that you spend a lot of time just developing your concentration on the breath as an aid to really kind of arriving to being here in the present moment a little bit more than you would be if you were, you know, distracted all the time. And but mindfulness is part of just investigating, being present for stuff and getting to know what's actually happening here in the present moment better. What is our experience in the present moment? What is the experience of being in a body, feeling our body? What's the experience of having emotions and feelings? What is those experiences? To get to know them better, not to kind of brush them off or disrespect them or hold them at bay. But really, what is this? What is it to really feel our emotional life when our emotions are up? What is it to feel our embodied physical life when our body is, you know, such a huge part of being a human being? What is it to be involved in a mind that thinks a lot? What are thoughts? When you find yourself lost and preoccupied in a lot of thinking, have you ever studied, not the story you're telling yourself, but have you ever wondered, what is a thought? Thoughts are the most ephemeral, insubstantial reality the universe produces. And it's the one we take as being the most substantial. The only thing we ever cling to, ultimately, kind of, are concepts, our ideas. And concepts and ideas are just thoughts. They have no color, they have no shape, they have no location. You can't go look for one. You can't hold one up and show it to anyone. You know, the thing that was so important and preoccupied you, maybe for very good reason, a year ago, maybe, you know, where is it now? The thing you were completely consumed with, the fantasy you had this morning, where is it now? There's many, you know, I remember once doing walking meditation. And walking meditation is often a time where my mind is kind of busy. My mind tends to be a little busier in walking meditation and sitting. So, you know, I was thinking. And a little bit, teeny bit maybe. Every once in a while, maybe. And so I was thinking. And so, you know, I was walking back and forth. So I walked to the end of my walkway. I turned around. And then I took three steps back. And when I took three steps back, I was standing again, facing the other direction, exactly where I had been 3 seconds before. And I remembered 3 seconds before, when I was in that very spot, I was really latched on to a particular thought. It seemed, you know, so important, so monumentally significant. And I was just really involved in it. And now 3 seconds later, standing in the same place, where was it? What happened to it? It was nowhere. And these things are so insubstantial. So anyway, to investigate, you know, what is it to think? If you really, that's what's really happening for you. What is thoughts? How solid are they? Or energetically, what's going on in your body when you're thinking? What's the beginning of a thought like? What's the end of a thought like? Have you ever investigated the space between your thoughts? Are you thinking constantly? Is it one thought kind of overlaps the next one? So like before you finish one thought, another thought's already happening, so there's no space? Is that how you think? Or do you actually come to bring kind of a thought to an end, like a period, the end of your sentences? And then there's, is there a little bit of space at the end of your thoughts? And if there is space between your thoughts, who are you in that space? Have you ever thought about that? Who are you in the space between your thoughts? And for some people, this is a very important investigation, because for some people, who they think they are is their thoughts, or the thinking person, the thinking capacity, is the self for many people. They can't imagine there's any self beyond that which is constantly doing the thinking. But if there's a part of you that exists after one thought is end and before a new one begins, if you're still existing in that space, then who really are you? Anyway, there's a lot of fun things you can investigate. But the point is that one part of mindfulness is actually getting to know better what's actually happening here in the present moment. And in getting to know it better, the better we get to know stuff, the easier it is not to be attached to it, not to be caught by it. So a lot of mindfulness is about investigation. At the same time, another part of mindfulness practice is beginning to appreciate the awareness itself. In order to be mindful, there has to be awareness. And awareness, so there's two things. There's the object of awareness, what we can study, investigate, and understand, get to know better. And then there's also that which we, the awareness which is aware of things. There's mindfulness itself. And the awareness which is aware of things becomes stronger and stronger as we do the mindfulness practice, until it becomes obvious to you that the awareness itself is independent, can exist independently from what it's aware of. For most people, we don't even see that awareness is something separate from what we're aware of. And one of the ways to develop this wonderful, help you discover this wonderful independence of awareness is to practice mindfulness, a mindfulness which does that, which is to develop a non-reactive awareness, where what is happening in the present moment doesn't have to be any different than what it is, but simply allowing what's happening to be there as it is, and discover that capacity of presence which doesn't have to push it away or hold on to it, but simply allows all things to be just as they are. And when we give everything its freedom, we become enlightened. I like it to say it that way, because many people, we're so self-centered that we think that that enlightenment is something we attain. I get enlightened, or that person gets, it's something I'm going to get. But enlightenment is an experience of release, of freedom. And one way of understanding it is, finally, all the objects of awareness have been granted their freedom from us. Isn't that great? So enlightenment is our freedom, it's our gift to the entire world. So the entire world is no longer in the clutches of our attachments and clingings and fears.